This is David Duke. And this is David Duke, and this is the David Duke Internet Web Radio Broadcast, broadcasting to the entire world with news and information for Europeans and people of European descent, wherever they may dwell, and truly for all people around the world who are interested in freedom and heritage, and certainly globalism and the machinations of international Zionism is a threat to everyone, not just the European. Indeed, look what's going on right now in the Middle East, and that's the hot spot of the world. It's a part of the world that is full of peril, not just for the people who live there, but for all nations. If there is the unthinkable prospect of something called a Third World War or a nuclear war, certainly the best prospects, or you might say the worst prospects for that, would come from the Middle Eastern area. The neocons are boldly talking about the fact that they believe in World War IV. They call the Cold War the World War III, and they want now a World War IV, and they want to exercise their dominion, really, over the earth. The Iraq War, of course, from the point of view of an American such as myself, is that Iraq was a war for Israel, not for the United States. As all the listeners of this program know, America's gotten no additional oil out of this war. We could have bought oil from Saddam Hussein even cheaper. Oil prices wouldn't have skyrocketed except for the fact of this war. This war has hurt the economy of not only America but of Europe and, in fact, of all the emerging countries in the world because it's driven up oil prices. This war was, from the very beginning, conceived and orchestrated by the Jewish neocons such as Richard Perle and Paul Wolfowitz. Now, I have a guest today. And my guest has been on the program before. His name is Khalid Al-Rashad, and he is of Syrian ancestry. And he's a teacher, educated man, and really a fine analyst about what's going on in the world. We've heard a lot about Syria in the news, and he can offer us some commentary and some point of view, some perspective that we don't here in our Jewish-dominated media in the United States of America, our Jewish supremacist-dominated media. And so we're going to go to him in a moment. And in preface, before I do that, I want to mention to you again that war between the United States and Syria may well be imminent. It's not because of anything the Syrians apparently are doing. It's really because the Jewish neocons, who now seem to be in control of American foreign policy, want this war. Now, the Iraq War was started by these neocons. The two main framers of the war, of course, were Richard Perle and Paul Wolfowitz. Now, Perle and Wormser collaborated together years earlier, in 1995, in writing a paper called A Clean Break, Securing the Realm, A Clean Break, and it's about the securing of Israel's realm. It was about war with Iraq, Syria, and Iran. And one of the interesting things in this paper was that they said, and I'll quote, that the way to Damascus was through Baghdad. And one of their major goals, one of the major Zionist and Jewish goals for many, many years, has been the destruction of Syria, one of its main opponents, in terms of the long-lasting conflict that we've had between the Jewish Zionists in the Middle East and, of course, the Palestinians and the other people who dwell in the Middle East. So I have with me, again, a very fine scholar who's a teacher. He's been lecturing recently in one of the major preeminent institutions here in Moscow. He's traveled the world and lectured, and in fact, I'm going to let him tell you something about himself. And we'll talk about this whole Syrian question and get his perspective on these issues. Well, Khalid, it's great to have you on the program again.
Thank you.
And why don't you tell the listening audience around the world a little bit about some of your educational background or what you've lectured on. I know that you were recently...
Yes, I graduated from Moscow State University, Institute of Asian and African Studies. And I specialize in Arabic world, and Arabic history, Arabic economy, and now I'm getting my PhD degree last year in Diplomatic Academy by the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of Russian Federation, and giving a lecture of contemporary Arabic history and Arab-Israel conflict.
Fantastic. And you've actually lectured, I understand, in Japan recently?
Yes, in Japan, in Iran, in Georgia, in India. And I traveled a lot all over the world. And
you've met a lot of the leaders around the world, haven't you, on some of these issues and some of the scholars.
Leaders, yes, very interesting scholars from all the world, Americans, British, French, even the scholars, Israeli scholars from the new historical movement called the New Historians in Israel, who actually are all the time oppose the government and the Likud party, the leading party in Israel. And these historians are realistics. They show the facts. They tell us about the hidden information that Israel hides from all over the world about the terror of Israeli government in Palestine and in Lebanon. And actually, these historians are very interesting people.
Now, let's before we go into the details of your positions and your views, let's talk a little bit about what is the history of Syria? Where do the Syrian people come from? What's their origin?
Syrians, it's very difficult to talk about Syrians ethnically, because it's a very huge mixture of different cultures. Because, as you know, Syria is one of the richest historical place because of the different civilizations that was established in this territory, beginning from Phoenicians, Babylon, Byzantia, Arabic Caliphate, Ottoman Empire, and a lot of different cultures.
Well, as evidenced by the Assyrian language, is Assyrian. They have direct links with the Indo-European peoples, don't they?
Yes.
In fact, I think my listeners would be interested to know, and I've met a number of Syrians, and Syrians come in a range of hues and characteristics, but you're a very light-eyed person,
Yes, there in Syria and Lebanon particularly, there is a lot of blonde, blue-eyed people. Mm-hmm. Because you see, those are didn't mix with anybody, with the Arabs or with the Turks. There is a lot of Christians, about 20% in Syria and about 30% in Lebanon, mm-hmm. Catholics and Orthodox and a few of Protestants. So this is, I think, the Syria is a very good example of religious tolerance. Mm-hmm. And the good relations without any violence between different ethnic groups and different religions. In Syria, there is Arabs, there is Armenians, there is Kurds, and there is Christianity, there is Islam, right. There is Druze.
Well, that's not the way the Zionists want to portray you, that's for sure.
Yes. You see, I think if we go back to the Arab-Israel conflict, one of the weapons that Israel used to make Arabic countries more weak is to make different political groups and ethnic groups and religious groups fight each other.
They succeeded
in that in Lebanon. And we know about the civil war in Lebanon. A lot of people killed, Christians, Muslims. And by the way, some militias were responsible for the massacre of Sabra and Shatila in 1982. So This is the policy of the foreign policy or the weapons of policy of Israel and some other countries who want to, from Arabic world, to be weak and to be very sensitive.
Well, you know, for our listeners, and I hope by now that 95% of our listeners have read My Awakening in Jewish Supremacism. But if you remember, Khalid, that in my book I even quote from the papers of the former Jewish prime minister, Israeli prime minister, who himself admits the fact that Israel had a major role in trying to cause the Lebanese Christians and Muslims fight each other and kill each other. They would plant bombs, and then blame them on each other's side. They would put out inflammatory propaganda. This has been their standing operating procedure for an awful long time, and of course that was culminated in what the butcher of Beirut, Ariel Sharon, did at the Sabra and Shatila, where Ariel Sharon and the Israelis presided over a massacre of a lot of Palestinians and Syrians, by the way, by some of the Christian groups, I think somewhere between 1,000 and 2,000 men, women, and children were slaughtered. And Ariel Sharon accomplished two things by doing that. One is he killed a lot of Palestinian, and by the way, he knew this was going on. The Jewish troops were guarding the gates. Mm-hmm. They let these militiamen in. They heard the firing. They heard the killing. Even the Khan Commission accused him of this. But they killed a lot of their enemies, the Palestinians, and at the same time, they increased the hatred between the groups, because obviously the Muslim elements and the Palestinians became to hate the Christian elements.
Yes. Actually, it's very interesting that Israel, of course, it's a small country, and all the countries around, like Syria and Lebanon, Jordan, is also a small country. And Israel, I don't think that Israel will go for a new war with the Arabic countries, because actually Israel is very small. And the infrastructure cannot permit. I mean, the government of Israel, they cannot stay in war for a long time, because that will mean the destruction of Israeli infrastructure and economy.
Mm-hmm.
Because if there will be a war, all the Israelis will be involved, and the economy will crash. The Israeli economy will crash.
It's already crashing.
And actually, yes, Israel is a very small country, and all Israel is settlements. And settlements, and if you come out from one town, you enter the second one immediately, because all the people live just beside. There's no free place. Everywhere there are people.
Right.
You see, so any missile coming from any Arabic country, anywhere it fall, it will cause casualties and injured people.
Right.
So Israel, the weapon of Israel now to, against Arabic countries around, mm-hmm. is to influence economic influence. So Israel, they give wrong information to Americans about the threat of Iraq, for example, and about the plan of Saddam Hussein, and about the weapon of mass destruction.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think, was one of the causes of the American war on Iraq. Wrong information given to the American security. And the cooperation between Israeli and American secret services, I think it's they get a lot of wrong information from Israeli secret services.
Of course, of course.
So this is one. And the second thing is that Israel...
Well, there was an Israeli... Again, I have this listed on my website. There was an Israeli general that admitted the fact that Israel supplied America with a lot of the false information.
Yes.
That they used, that the neocons, the Jewish neocons, used to get us in this war against Iraq. A war not for American interest, but for Israeli interest. And of course, it was our guns, our money, and our blood that was spent.
Yes, exactly.
In this war.
Exactly. So, of course, it's Israel is very happy because they solved one of the them problems with the American hands. Using American weapons and American young men to solve one of to get rid from one of the threats. I mean Saddam Hussein.
Right.
So they used Americans to serve their own interests.
Right.
Because Iraq couldn't. It's obvious to everyone that Iraq and Saddam Hussein didn't threat. It's not a threat for America, for such a country like America. In Iraq, not a single missile of Iraqi missile can reach more than 1,000 kilometers. It means just it can reach Israel, but not far than
one
Israel.
Or two,
yes,
you know, yeah.
But of course, it's very silly to think that one of America, one of Saddam missiles can go through the Atlantic Ocean and reach the Americans. It's stupid. And of course, there was wrong information about the connections between Saddam regime and Osama bin Laden. It's very stupid because Saddam regime, it's the party of Arabic revivalism, and it's actually it's a socialist party. It's not Islamic party. And from Islamic point of view, from Ibn Laden's point of view, Saddam regime is atheistic regime. It's opposite to Islam and to
secular.
Yes, secular regime. Yes. So it's stupid to think that Saddam Hussein could ever make any plans with Ibn Laden or something like that. So this was also wrong information. So we have a lot of wrong information given to the United States.
Bin Laden, in fact, condemned Saddam Hussein a number of times, didn't
yes.
he, before this
yes.
whole process.
And I think it's obvious that the threat of North Korea, first of all, it's closer to the border of the United States. It's
right.
very closer. And the second, everybody knows that South Korea has the weapon of mass destruction.
North Korea.
North Korea has the nuclear weapon. Everybody know that. But you see, nobody cares about the weapons North Korea now have.
And while they were being developed,
yes,
we knew they were being developed,
country,
but they made no issue of it. So
yes.
We knew, obviously, the CIA, we knew these were being developed for years. There was no interest in it, no serious interest in it, not like what happened with Saddam Hussein, because, again, there was no Israeli interest there.
Yes, yes. So
that was just American cities that could be threatened by a nuclear holocaust,
yes.
like Alaska
yes.
and perhaps Washington State.
Yes.
That's not something the Americans should be concerned about.
Mm-hmm.
But if you get concerned about Israel with their neighbors being strong, now that's something America's got to
yes.
got to concentrate on.
So this is the point. So we see now that one of the threats of Israel was just terminated. It's Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
What we have rest? We have Syria, a quite strong country, and a lot of Russian weapons they have. Syria has the biggest quantity of missiles in all the Arabic countries. We have also Iran, very strong country, which is threatening Israel, according to the Israeli security service. So what Israel wants now from America, and I think that Israel will continue supplying America with collaborate with some Jewish lobbyists in America to also use America to terminate the threats, Syrian and Iranian threats. And they now started from the first step is to get rid of Syria and for Syrian threats. What they want to do now is to provoke the America and make them push into Syria and into Lebanon. First of all, Israeli, they want to get rid of Hezbollah, the militias who are who liberated the north of Lebanon
from Israeli occupation.
From Israeli occupation, and they want to get rid of from this organization because it's a very strong organization. They believe what they do. It's not terroristic organization because they didn't do any They didn't fight Israeli civilians, they fought only Israeli soldiers who occupied Lebanese territories. And this organization is supplied by Iran and partially from Syria. So the first step is to get rid of this organization. Mm-hmm. And I think that the killing of al-Hariri, the ex-prime minister, Lebanese prime minister, served only the interest of Israel. And I don't think that Syria is involved. I mean, the government of Syria involved in this assassination, because it's stupid. Because if we see at the if we take a look at the consequences, we see that it didn't serve not the interests of Syria and not the interests of Lebanon, and it's only served the interest of Israel, because this assassination followed by the resolution of 1554, if I'm not mistaken, mm-hmm. That says that Hezbollah should be disarmed, and the support of Hezbollah by, from Syria and Iran has to be stopped, and Syrian Syrians troops has to be taken out from Lebanon. You see, and we know, everybody knows who studies the region, that Syria was the Syria and the Syrian troops and Syrian army in right. Lebanon was the the reason of the stability in the region.
Exactly.
In Lebanon and in Syria, because
Let me ask you a question. I mean, if Israel's policy was to divide and conquer Princess Lebanon, its neighbor, and cause civil war in that country, it's in their interest, obviously, to end Syrian occupation.
Yes.
Not occupation. It's not really occupation, but it's Syrian sort of control over this, over our military involvement.
It's not occupation, because it was according to the agreement between Syrians like and, the and Lebanese.
The,
it was
the,
it wasn't the occupation, because
right.
occupation, if somebody is against the will of the government or the citizens,
right.
the people. So it was according to the agreement, and Lebanese said, "Please come and solve the problems we have. Solve this."
Well, wasn't Syrian presence, their military presence, absolutely essential in Lebanon, because that was the only way they could end this terrible bloodshed, men, women, and children, and dying
yes,
between
exactly.
between the civil war between the Christians and
exactly,
non-Christians.
Exactly.
And didn't the Syrian troops, weren't they able to end that terrible
yes,
bloodshed?
Yes. So the first step, I think, the first step to destabilize the region is to pull out the Syrian troops from Lebanon.
Right.
Second, stop the disarmament of Hezbollah, and to put the obstacles on the way of supporting Hezbollah from Syria Syria and Iran.
Mm-hmm.
Because what Hezbollah actually does is they it's the only party that could liberate the part of Arabic land, I mean Lebanon.
Yep.
So it's very strong organization, and not connected to the political movements anywhere. And they do just what they think, what they believe.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's nobody can buy this the leaders of this movement with money or something. Offer them money to stop the resistance or something.
Okay, well, why don't you hold it right there for a second? I want to let our listeners know who you are and what we're doing for those who just tuned in to the program. And I'm speaking with Khalid Al-Rashad, and he is of Syrian ancestry. It's pretty interesting. He's if you saw him somewhere, say in Hannibal, Missouri, you'd think he was either Tom Sawyer or Huck Finn. He's got light eyes. He's very proud of his Assyrian ancestry and his roots that go there. And by the way, he's a teacher. He lectures at a number of different universities and educational institutions. He's lectured all over the world. He's fluent in, of course, Arabic. He's fluent in Russian. He can speak also, I think,
English and French. Yes.
English and French. And it's a kind of amazing, these kind of talents that he does have. And he's doing this interview with probably his weakest language, which is English. And I'm so happy to have him on the program and be so well-spoken. So that's who we have as the guest today. And also I'm going to get in some of his comments on some of the riots in France, because he has some very interesting perspectives on that in a moment. But first I want to go back to the Lebanese and the Syrian incidents. And I want to call your attention and that of our listeners to what happened in terms of the Israeli occupation of Lebanon. Of course, Israel invaded Lebanon in the late 70s. In their invasion of Lebanon against the Lebanese people, they destroyed a great deal of the historic and beautiful city of Beirut, a city thousands of years old and rich in human culture and heritage. They killed between 30 and 60,000 men, women, and children. They destroyed 100,000 homes. Robert Fisk writes about one of the terrible massacres of the Israelis of a United Nations protected civilian column at Aquana, which I talk about in my book, Jewish Supremacism. And the interesting thing is that the United Nations voted for Israel to leave Lebanon, and even the United States voted for that resolution, and Israel did not leave Lebanon for how many years was it? 17 or 18 years?
Yes, yes.
16, at least 16
for 15 years. Yes.
And so here's a situation. So here's Israel going into a country not invited, terribly oppressing the people, setting up torture chambers, supporting the civil war, orchestrating this massacre, for instance, in Beirut at the Sabra and Shatila. And with doing all this, there was no big claim by any American president or any American leaders, oh, we've got to end the Israeli occupation of Lebanon. In fact, we supported Israel during this time with guns, bombs, planes, and billions of American dollars. And here's a situation where Syria, and by the way, Lebanon was at one time part of Syria, wasn't it, historically?
Sorry?
Lebanon was actually part of Syria.
Yes, yes, it's a big city. It's, we call it big Syria. It includes Syria, Lebanon, and Jordan, and Palestine.
So the Syrians, who were very popular with most of the people, they were certainly welcome by most of the people to end the civil war. They didn't set, you know, the occupation was no way like what happened in Israel. They didn't kill thousands of people. They didn't bulldoze, you know, hundreds of 100,000 homes and residences. Suddenly, this becomes a terrible thing of occupation. And again, the Israelis and the Americans go in, they go to the residents of Lebanon, they try to fan the flames, they'll get the Syrians out and use political things.
Yes.
And then now we finally have the assassination of Harari. It's interesting, this assassination took place right as the big push for getting Syria out of there took
place. Exactly. We see that this assassination served the interests of Israel. And we say that, you see, it's very obvious, because if we take a look at this very organization, Hezbollah, we see that this organization, now, of course, they don't threat anybody. They just only...
they oppose Israel
only,
and support the Palestinians.
What they do, actually, is they oppose Israel without any military acts. Just politically, they oppose Israel,
right?
And they don't bother anybody but Israel in the world. And we see now that the international community and the government of the United States, they want from Hezbollah to be disarmed. Why? Does Hezbollah threat Americans' interests? Does it threat Europeans? No. It's just oppose politically Israel. That's it. Because they need from this 10% of unliberated territories to be liberated. I mean,
you compare that to what Israel did to us, the attack on the USS Liberty, 173 Americans terribly maimed and wounded, 34 Americans dead. You look at the attack of the Levant Affair, where they blew up American installations in Egypt. You look at the spying Israel's done against
us,
and nobody's demanding Israel disarm.
Yes, yes. Secondly, if you see I think the assassination of al-Hariri, if we take a look how many people and how many politicians assassinated all over the world, a lot of.
Sure.
And never the international community reacted from the for the assassination like they do now. Never it happened before.
Israeli assassinates people every day who are political opponents.
Yes, yes.
And where's the condemnation there?
Sure. So I think that...
And by the way, the United Nations report so far I'm very skeptical of. It's not hard. The Israelis, they're the... like the Mossad says, you know, by way of deception thou shalt wage war. That's their theme. And that theme also, I think, can express the whole Jewish supremacist issue all over the world. By way of deception, thou shalt wage war. They don't go to the American people and say, we want you to go fight and die and spend $300 billion and countless American lives and maim Americans fighting for Israel against Iraq. So they manufacture this false evidence and say America's being threatened by Saddam and Americans have to go fight Saddam to be safe. It's by deception, thou shalt wage war. They know that they can spend just a little money in bribes, just a few million dollars on an international level. By the level of countries, that's no money. And they can bribe officials to write reports that they want, to make conclusions that they want. And I'm very suspicious of this United Nations report. In fact, they have very little tangible evidence showing Syrian involvement in the assassination of Harari. And if you read the reports, you see, most of it is simply conjecture. One of the major conjectures I read in one of the first articles, and I want to get your comment on this, they said that, we think that it's Syria that did it because it appears the scope of this action, the huge bomb and the way the planning was done, that it would had to have taken a national intelligence network or a large intelligence organization, state-run intelligence organization to do this thing. Well, just by saying that proves nothing. I mean, there's lots of large national intelligence organizations. The Mossad has the most bloodthirsty, murderous intelligence organization in the world. Just saying that does not imply that Syria committed this assassination.
Yes, sure. And more than that, I think that the question of Syrian presence in Lebanon, it's only Syrian and Lebanese question. So Syria and Lebanon, these two parts have to discuss the problem of Syrian military presence in Lebanon. Nobody else. It's nobody's business. Okay. So if it's not occupation, and if it's everybody knows that the Syrian presence in Lebanon was for good reasons, for the interests of Lebanon, so it's nobody's business. Syria and Lebanon has to discuss between themselves. I don't understand why the international community is very paid to this question that much of attention. And second, I think that the assassination of al-Hariri, first of all, nobody proved until now that the Syrian government is involved in this assassination. There is no evidence, no proof, absolutely. And we don't Lebanese themselves, officials, all of them, approximately all of them say that we doubt that Syria could do it. We don't think that Syria did it. All the Lebanese, if we ask the Lebanese,
sure.
If we ask...
well, not the ones that are in the pay of Israel.
Yes,
and
yes.
United
Nobody
States.
Thinks that Syria that Syria did it. And if Syrian government is not responsible for the assassination of al-Hariri, and nobody proved until now that it's responsible, if some non-officials, Syrians, did that, Syria as a country is not responsible.
Right.
Like Saudi Arabia as a government, they're not responsible for September 11th.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that most of these people who did this terrorist acts were Saudis.
But we know that Saudi Arabians, in fact, prosecute, condemn, give the death penalty to
yes,
those that they
yes,
find
sure.
who are terrorists.
And Syrians also, they said if some Syrians did that, we will punish them. We will get him and we will punish him.
Sure.
But we are not responsible. Nobody proved that Syria is responsible. So I don't understand why, without any evidence, without any reasons, we find this international pressure on Syria
Because it serves the clean break talked about by Richard Pearl and Wormser and the rest of these guys.
Exactly.
Let me. I also promised a couple things in this broadcast, and we're going to. We've gone almost our limited time. We're going to do this as two shows. So I'm going to break this up, ladies and gentlemen, and we're going to have the next show.
Okay.
We're going to start. Go ahead and work on that. That's going to be tomorrow. But first, before I break off for today. As a couple things that I want to give people a preview. One is that I understand you're working on a new book about some of the aspects of... could you explain the dissertation and the new book that you're working on?
Yes, it's the religion in the context of ethnopolitical conflict on the example of Arab-Israel conflict.
And
I'm studying that what's the part that extremist religious groups plays and the Arab-Israel conflict.
So you're especially going in, especially from what I understand, is you're going into the different aspects of extremism in terms of Judaism.
Yes, yes. I'm just trying to make clear the division between political extremism as a Zionist extremism and a religious extremism.
Do you think there's a serious danger from both?
I think so.
And that's something not talked about too much, even in the Arabic world, because people tend to say, we're just opposed to political Zionism, we have no problem with Judaism.
I believe that the relationship between political extremism or political movements and religious movements not only threat the others, I mean the other countries or neighbors. I think it can threaten the country itself because...
Okay, well, let's say what we're going to do. We're going to talk about that on tomorrow's program, and I know people are going to be interested in hearing that because you have a lot of interesting information on some of the radical extremist groups in Israel and how that's affecting this whole conflict. But also, I promised our listeners, and I was talking with you earlier before the show, and being a person of Arabic heritage and being a person who's a very fine scholar and a nonviolent person, you were discussing with me and we were talking about the riots that were going on in Paris and France and some other European capitals, and you were describing them to me as barbaric. I know our listeners would be interested in hearing your viewpoint on these and if you do condemn these kinds of actions, the carnage and the destruction of innocent life and the things that are going on there.
I think anybody would condemn this kind of actions. Muslims, Christians, Arabs, non-Arabs, Europeans, Africans. So there are some Africans who speak Arabic, but they are not Arabs actually. We can say that they're Arabs. If we look from the part of historical or cultural
geography or language,
geography or language or culture or history, common language, common culture, yes, we can say that they are Arabs. For example, we said Soviets for Armenians and Azerbaijanis and Russians. Everybody were Soviets.
We're all Soviets.
But they spoke one language.
But these are.
But ethnically,
are a different breed altogether.
Yes, they weren't Russians. All of them. We couldn't say Russians.
That's an interesting analysis.
Yes. Yes. So they are barbarians.
You know, I certainly consider you a friend and a colleague in the struggle against anti-Zionism and. And as you know, I respect the Islamic people around the world, and they're maintaining their own nations. At the same time, I absolutely insist that my own homelands retain our culture and our heritage and our respective faith. That any Arabic nation would want to preserve its religious traditions, its cultural traditions,
yes,
its
exactly.
ethnic traditions.
Exactly.
People never wanted the immigration to begin with.
Yes.
The politicians
yes.
did. In fact, the Jewish supremacists were the ones that really were behind this because it's the same divide and conquer strategy that they use
yes.
in Lebanon and
yes.
Syria
yes.
and the Arabic world. And they see these conflicting groups that come in
yes.
as a way for them to divide, conquer, maintain their power.
Yes.
In fact, even in my book, I quote Jews that literally say this.
Yes.
But the issue is that you know, we were talking about earlier that you know that obviously every nation's got the right to maintain its heritage. Mm-hmm. You were talking about United Arab Emirates.
Yes.
And how that they have people that come there from 80 countries.
You see, here is absolutely different story. Why? Because if we take a look at United Arab Emirates, we see that all the immigrants, most of the immigrants that go to the UAE to work, they first of all they don't get Arab nationality of UAE. They don't get the nationality. They have only the permit to live temporarily.
They don't get welfare.
Yes, they don't consider themselves as Emiratis.
Right.
Because the Hindus, they know that they are Hindus. The Syrians, for example, they know that they are Syrians.
Right.
Nobody considers that they are Emiratis, the
right.
citizens of Emirates, okay?
Right.
And where they go, if you take a look about the, even in sports, even in French sports, we have a lot of barbarians. And barbarians, they are, people from South Africa, from North Africa, sorry.
Then you would say, and you believe, that the European people should have this. In fact, you used United Arab Emirates as like an example.
Yes.
Every right to try to maintain their own particular culture, their own
yes.
ethnic control of their own country,
yes.
their own religious values, and that the immigration is totally controlled, and that
yes.
people, if they come and stay, then they leave after their work is done?
Yes, I think that French people and all the Europe must to think about this question very seriously. Because I think that they now pay the price of the fault they made before. Because they should have controlled this immigration from the beginning. Not now, not thinking about now, when there is half a million of Arabic immigrants.
And it's still going on.
Yes, and still going on.
And the
yes.
birth rates differential too. It's,
because
it's a terrible problem.
Yes, I think it's very late now for French or Britain to think about Hindu or Arab immigration.
But
because
if they don't start thinking about it now, they're going to be completely
overwhelmed. If they don't start thinking about now, yeah. they will feel themselves in 20 or 30 years the minority.
That's exactly right. Look, we're going to continue this discussion tomorrow, and I'm very thankful that you could take the time out of your busy schedule, and I know you're researching your new book now, to spend a little time with us. And we will be back again tomorrow. This has been David Duke, and this is the David Duke Internet Web Radio Broadcast. And we'll be back with you tomorrow, 9 a.m. Eastern Time in the United States, and, of course, other recording times around the world. We'll be back with you tomorrow, and I'll continue this interview with Khalid Al-Rashad. Very insightful commentary on the Middle East and the conflicts that are endangering this world. I'll also be able to have an opportunity to deal with this on stormfront.org, the town hall section and commentary. And I'm anxious to receive your emails on these issues at info44@davidduke.com. Thanks so much, and I'll see you again tomorrow.
This has been David Duke for our heritage and our freedom.